Hi, welcome to episode number 100 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is the amazing, incredible Dan Brown, a web designer from Washington, D.C. Dan, hello.
Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for making time today. Before we get into it, I want to do a quick thank you to our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Audible, the leading provider of audiobooks. And Big Web Show listeners can download a free ebook on us and get an extended free trial of the service by going to audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. And we'll have more to say about that later, but let's talk about, speaking of books, you're the author of several important ones. One is part of the canon, Communicating Design. You also have created a Surviving Design Projects, a card game for creative teams, which I had the pleasure of using a couple of days ago with Whitney Hess and some attendees at the Digital DPM Summit.
Yes.
In Philadelphia, and seeing how you used it. And they're, these cards for listeners, they're like, they're kind of like the cards Brian Eno and a collaborator came up with, oblique strategies for. In their case, they were solving creative blocks. You know, what do you do when you're in the studio and you don't like the mix, but you don't know what to do next? Dan, coming from the world of UX and design, has created cards for dealing with things that happen when you're collaborating with people, which, you know, good and bad. And now you have a new book, which I have in my hands, Designing Together, the Collaboration and Conflict Management Handbook for Creative Professionals, with a foreword by Scott Birkin, with contributions by Erica Hall and Mandy Brown and Jonathan Knoll and Janine Turner and Denise Jacobs and a whole bunch of amazing people, but mostly by you. And it's about the thing that's not taught in design school, but is an essential survival skill for practicing designers. It's a really interesting book, and we're going to be talking about that and lots more. But first, Dan, let's talk a little bit about you and how you got here. Did you actually go to design school yourself?
No, unfortunately, I did not. Let me rephrase. I'm very happy with the education that I received, but I was in school back before there really was any sort of web design practice or industry. And I went to a small liberal arts college and was exposed to a lot of cool and interesting things. And my freshman year there, I took a Introduction to Philosophy class, kind of fell in love with the ancient philosophers. And so I studied philosophy in school. And it was great. I mean, it allowed me to develop my writing skills, my critical thinking skills, and sort of in a way that was kind of predictionary. Is that a real word? That predicted what I would be thinking about later. I liked focusing on social philosophy, how people think about each other.
Predictive, I think,
is that would be a better, much better word.
That yes. A friend of mine and a collaborator on the Web Standards Project 20 years ago had been a philosophy major, and philosophy majors are kind of great because they're really smart, and a lot of half baked things that you do as an argument, they kind of say, yeah, that doesn't work because, yeah, you're basically attacking the person, or you're basically, you know, you have no data. You have, you know, that argument makes no sense.
For me, I found it really useful as an information architect. That's sort of the design background that I grew into. My role on projects is to kind of think through processes and think through flows, and kind of being able to anticipate all the potential rabbit holes that users may find themselves in.
Are you the killjoy who, you know, the client says, I really want to do this, and you're like, yeah, here's why we shouldn't. Or the designer says, it'll be really exciting too, and you're like, yeah, but it won't be useful, so we're not going to do it. I mean, are you that guy?
I don't know, maybe isn't every UXer to that person to a certain extent to sort of just kind of rein it in and say, let's refocus on the purpose, right? What are people trying to accomplish? So what I find is that designers don't mind constraints. But
yeah, you can't design without them. It's not design without them.
Right. But what we'll do is have an internal brainstorming session, usually before we hold a big collaborative one with the client. And that's our opportunity to maybe ignore some of the constraints or push on some of the boundaries. And that exercise, even though it's early in the project, kind of helps us understand the design problem.
Now, you've been doing this about, like me, about 20 years.
Yeah.
Right? You started designing websites in 1995.
Yeah.
How, and I'm going to assume this was soon after that liberal arts college.
Very soon, yeah.
Very soon after. Okay. Yes. Based on your youthful appearance.
That's right? Nice of you to say.
Okay. So you're out of college. Maybe, I don't know, did you like work in a gas station for a while before you, how did you become a web designer? What was the?
So it was 1994. Those many years ago, I just graduated from college, and I'd always been into computers. I'm one of, you know, those guys who was always into computers. Had a Commodore 64 growing up, and taught myself how to program in BASIC, and aced all the computer programming classes in high school. Then the web started to emerge in college, just a little bit. I got really into using email. Gopher was the big thing back then. Right. So I was exposed to internet technologies. But it was really pretty much just as I graduated that the things started to explode. I moved down to North Carolina to seek my fortune after college.
Why there?
I'm sorry?
Why there?
So the short version of that story is that...
A girl?
Carolina, no. Turned out to be a girl, but Carolina has a really good library science program. And so I intended to become a librarian after having worked for my parents for the summer after I graduated. I was doing a lot of research for them. They were making a documentary at the time.
So
I was doing
a lot of research.
Not really. My dad is a professor of film at NYU. And at the time, they were collaborating on a documentary around the latest version of the Frankenstein movie. So they made a documentary for A&E about the Frankenstein phenomena.
Was that the one with De Niro?
Yes, the movie had De Niro in it as the monster.
Okay.
Yes. And Kenneth Branagh as Dr. Frankenstein.
Okay, so not all my brain cells from then are dead.
No. The 90s were a good time for us.
Yeah, they were.
So,
right, it's the preceding decade that, yeah.
We shall not speak of that.
We won't.
So I was spending a lot of time in the New York Public Library doing research for them, acquiring images that they could use on the show, and I just loved it.
From the picture collection.
Yes, yeah.
I will admit that I stole pictures from the picture collection when I was moving to New York. In the late 80s, just sad, but I was in advertising. My portfolio was so terrible that I had to throw out the portfolio of produced work from my 2 years experience before then, and make a fake portfolio.
Sure,
And so I went to the library and I did that. But you checked
all
them out
before Google Images,
right? Right. That's what we had to do. But you checked them out legitimately, I assume that.
Yes. Or photocopied them there under the supervision of, you know, I was only 20 years old, 22 years old. So anyway, I loved it. I loved being in the library. And I thought, I'm going to become a librarian. A couple of college friends were living in North Carolina. So I thought, let me go earn some residency there and I'll pay for grad school real cheap. And then it turned out I need to become an adult and get a job. I'd started dabbling in HTML and teaching myself HTML. I got hooked up with a book publishing company called Ventana Press. They no longer exist, but they were publishing books about the internet, right around the same time that O'Reilly had started publishing books about the internet. And I worked in their online section. We were selling books online before Amazon even existed. And that was, I mean, it was such great experience. I was in my early 20s. I was learning everything about the web and about business.
Were you were you an intern, a marketer, a webmaster? What was your title?
What did they call me? I think I was just a web designer, trying to remember. But I was a jack of all trades.
Like I still love that job title. I still love that. I still use that job title, at least among us. If I'm on a plane and someone says, what do you do? I say, I design things on the internet because, and I call it the internet because it's easier.
Yes, yes.
But, so I'm spreading misinformation.
I still feel like web designer is, you know, it's not, it seems maybe outdated, but it still captures everything that we do in my firm today. So
it captures everything that you do and that I do, but perhaps to an outsider, it sounds like a kid with Front Page.
That's true. I can see that.
I don't know. So there you are.
There I am
thinking about library science, and you've gone to this publishing company because you needed a real job, still in North Carolina. And I remember Ventana Press. I remember seeing.
Do you?
Yeah, I can't quote titles to you, but I definitely remember seeing web design and owning web design books from those guys.
Yeah.
This was before Lynda.com.
Yep. Yep.
And Lynda Weinman was around. Doing books, I think, for your publisher, New Writers. I think that's who she started with before
she... Yes, that sounds right.
And I think she's still affiliated with in some... I think Lynda.com and Peach Pit are affiliated in some capacity. I'm pretty sure that's true. But so you're doing everything. You're doing
amazing things. They published books about... I remember Acrobat came out probably 96, 97, something like that. And they published a book about Acrobat. And I remember us all sitting around in our office just laughing like, PDF, that's never going to go anywhere. That's ridiculous. Why would you do that?
Really?
Yeah. I just remember sitting around thinking, such a silly thing.
The paperless office, you didn't buy into that hype?
We were such internet nerds that we were like, why can't it just be HTML?
Oh, okay.
Everything should be
HTML. I love you. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah. So
We're just having them. Yeah. Okay. Anyway,
it's the same conversation.
It's the same conversation over and over. Yeah.
Okay. This is why it was great to be a philosophy major, right? Because we're still having the same conversations Plato and Socrates were having thousands
of
years ago.
That's true.
Anyway,
and some of the same kind of parties.
I met my wife and we got married and we moved to DC. And I got a job at a big internet consulting company called US Web. And was finally around kind of other, a larger team of designers. And that was kind of the late 90s. We were starting to formalize what user experience meant, what information architecture meant, and ended up focusing mostly on information architecture.
So. Were you guys paying attention to Razorfish, for example, or Cyent, what they were doing?
Yes. Yeah.
And so, working with people who'd worked at some of those places.
And then who left to go work at those places. And it was the time of the big internet consulting.
It was a weird time because it was when for a lot of people, it stopped being the Wild West and you just make it up as you go along and it became a business with rules. Although for me, I avoided that as long as I could. And for me, it was still, I was making it up as I went along. In fact, I kind of still feel that way, but that's another.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it's an industry that's, at once being much more mature, which is why I think some of the topics that I like thinking about are things that people are starting to be interested in. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we're still encountering new problems and new challenges that make it seem like we're still very much in our infancy and having to make up things as we go along.
Yeah, I really think that we're like silent movies that just went to two reels. Or they just discovered the close-up. Like, you don't have to shoot everything from a proscenium arch. You can actually close up on a character, and people won't think, there's a giant severed head. But they'll respond to it as part of storytelling. Yeah. But I really think we're there. I don't know. I imagine that at some point, just the whole idea that we were designing for any device will – I mean, the number of devices will and the kinds of devices will just be so have proliferated to such a degree, and the kinds of surfaces and everything else that we'll almost, we'll really just be designing UX. We'll really just be designing experiences that are, that have aspects that are contingent based on how you're encountering the content. But,
right.
We'll be nothing like design, the design that we grew up with.
Yeah, it's been interesting. H-Apes is, my firm has been doing a lot of responsive work, and it's been fantastic to be along for the ride and watch design teams that are dealing with kind of very complex design problems in and of themselves, trying to understand what this new language of constraints is. Because I take your point. I think breakpoints are really just another way of us saying the page has some kind of border.
Right. Object.
And at some point we need to stop thinking, I would assume, we need to stop thinking in terms of physical constraints of any sort.
Right. I'm thinking it's going to be, I mean, I can laugh at Google Glass in a way, but I mean, it's going to be, I check into my hotel and when I now, where I touch the thermostat, that's going to be a web interface, an internet right. interface of some, and I might be reading, I might not need to bring my iPad to read. I might be able to touch a surface somewhere and either get my stuff from the cloud or get new stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And television too. At some point, they'll stop being like, this is a TV, this is a phone, this is a computer. Those things may continue to exist for, you know, if I want to do Photoshop work, I still want my computer. But I think now, you know, that's what I envision now. Maybe I'm already, you know, limiting my thinking. But the point is, I think you'll be able to, there'll be ubiquitous computing for real. We've been talking about it for 10 years, but it'll be for real. And all kinds of services will have different ways of interacting with content. And there's still going to be someone responsible for authoring and editing the content and someone responsible for designing the experience. So we're kind of laying groundwork for all that. And I do think.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think what's going to be fascinating to watch is, as you say, designers thrive on constraints. We need to figure out what is the new language of constraints. How are we going to talk to each other about the boundaries of this project if we can't, you know, point at the corners of a screen? So.
Now, you specialize in how we talk to each other, and you've written two books on that subject and created a card series on that subject, and you go around the world conducting workshops on that subject. Was that something that you noticed early on in your web design career? As opposed to latching on to like CSS or latching on to Flash or something, you seem to have latched on to, I'm working with humans, and projects seem to have difficulty when humans disagree.
It's a good question. I mean, it became very clear in my very first job when I was a jack of all trades that I was really crappy at most of those things that I had to do. And I think that's why I gravitated towards something like information architecture, which ends up serving as a focal point for thinking about what the overall experience is going to be. I'd be hard-pressed to say exactly when team dynamics itself became very prominent for me, but I became aware that it was very clear, or I became aware that this was a clear challenge after the first book came out. Now, the first book is called Communicating Design, and that's about the artifacts that people create in service of the design
right.
process.
White papers,
wireframes, sitemaps, personas, things like that. And it wasn't necessarily the process of creating them, but it was what makes a good set of wireframes or what makes a good sitemap or how do I take my flowcharts to the next level? I would go around and do workshops.
Making it communicate. What makes it good in terms of someone else who hasn't even met me can take this and know what to build or know what to design?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the idea is the systems are far more complex than we can represent in any sort of design artifact. How can I be a responsible designer and, in a sense, give the artifact the responsibility of communicating all or part of the design?
Focusing on all those artifacts makes sense because it gets back to the point you were making that we're not delivering pages, that we're not delivering finished work. The internet's never done. The web's never done. You're sort of handing a client, if you're doing work for a client, a set of tools.
Yes.
That they're supposed to then use to do their content making and their
right.
they're communicating and they're selling or they're whatever their business happens to be, you're providing them with how they approach it.
Those artifacts are really a mechanism for getting teams to talk about the product that they're building.
Have you ever heard people criticizing deliverables as a problem? Just like,
oh yeah. Yeah. There was a huge backlash against, and I think continues to be a huge backlash against documentation.
Why?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the criticism is totally legitimate, which is, we got lost in building these artifacts and not building the thing itself, which I think is totally legitimate, but is not the fault of the artifact. And that's where I grow frustrated with the backlash. I feel like we're in such a new business. And as you say, we're still trying to figure out, and we still get new challenges thrown at us all the time. Why would you throw a tool away? Like, an experienced designer should have an array of tools that they can choose from and be able to pick those responsibly. So I strongly question the value of encouraging people to throw any tools out of their toolbox at this stage in our life.
You said, you know, that when you majored in philosophy, that you see that we're having the same conversations over and over again. And I think in our community, we have the same conversation over and over again, where there's a problem. Someone addresses that problem with a solution that goes part of the way of solving some of those problems. And then other people begin attacking that. And it all happens on a very generalized level. So, web standards are bad because, like, I remember people would say, yeah, web standards, you know, I ask my customer, do you care if I'm using valid HTML or not? My customer doesn't care. So web standards are stupid. And responsive design is like, you know, I mean, something new comes out or something comes out and starts to gain traction. And inevitably people complain that I don't know what, that, you know, it's like turnips come out and people love them. And then people complain that turnips really aren't rutabagas. And
right.
Like, that's true. Nobody said they were.
No.
Or they get blamed, you know. Websites are too big and it's all responsive design's fault. Well, actually, websites are too big. You're right. You know, and some responsive sites have that problem, but responsive design might be a way of solving it too, you know, depending on how you use the tool. Well,
we've been focusing more on an artifact that's an interactive prototype, right? It's meant to, in one sense, replace, say, a set of wireframes. But on, as you say, it can only get you part of the way there. You know, at some point, you still have to build the thing. But we can't build the thing unless we have the conversation about it, right? We need to have a conversation about what should it do? What should it not do? Should it really look like this? What are the priorities? Does this thing serve the purpose of the greater purpose of it?
How do you get engaged with, you're doing client engagements, right, with companies like Yahoo.
Yes.
How early do you start talking to them? How much research, talk me through one of your engagements, and even after you deliver, do you continue to be involved in some capacity after you deliver? Talk me through what an engagement looks like at 8Shapes.
We don't have a specific process. And Jeffrey, I think you've said this in a couple of your talks as well. It's hard for us to sort of characterize a particular proprietary the H-Shapes way process that we use. And that's because, I'm sorry.
Ouch.
And I think that's because we acknowledge that we're going to get thrown a lot of different design problems.
Right.
We're going to show up in the process and in their process in many different steps. They're going to ask us to focus on this part of the site or that part of the site. They're going to have a bunch of research or they're not going to have a bunch of research. So it really varies. This is a hallmark of a modern design firm is you got to be able to show up and deal with a lot of the circumstances in which a client is.
And you don't want to tie your own hands. I mean, constraints are fine, but you don't want to say, well, we're a nimble shop or we're a waterfall. We have a waterfall practice, or we do use this dogma or that dogma.
There's also too flexible, right? And not having a set of principles that you adhere to. So you might say that our principles are, you know, give us enough time to really understand the design problem, or give us some exposure to the target audience so we can talk to them first, or let us put a stake in the ground in terms of the design, and then let's come to a decision point. Should we keep going with this, or do you want to take it in a different direction, right? So there's some principles that we live by in terms of how we construct our projects. I have no, eight-step process that I could say is the H-Apes way.
Do you ever turn down a project, even a really tempting, promising project, because, for example, they won't let you do research, or they won't let you, or they say, no, we don't really, we just want you to build this thing, or we just want you to put a skin on this thing?
We get sometimes we get requests. We've already designed everything. We just want you to validate that we're heading in the right direction.
And a consulting gig.
Yeah. And that's just, another principle you might say is that we're designers. Ultimately, we want to put it, work with you to put it together. And that's not the kind of engagement that I would want. I'm talking to a prospective client now that definitely has a different project that we would normally take on. But the client is interesting enough. We can sort of conceive of it and still keep to our principles in a way that they are still excited about. But there are some things that are going to be uncomfortable about it, because it is kind of new. That being said, I'm so curious as to see where it's going to go, how it's going to end up. Just learn from this. Plus, if we can add value to our client, so much the better. I'll tell you, we mostly turn down clients when due to availability. I mean, we're a small shop, and we don't want to spread ourselves too thin. And clients typically call right when they need to start the project, and not 2 months ahead of time. So.
Right. I need to take a quick break here and thank our sponsor. Hang in there. Get yourself some water. Dan, get yourself some water. Listeners, don't necessarily get yourself some water. You want to stay here and hear this. The Big Web Show is sponsored in part by Audible, as I mentioned before. They are the leading provider of downloadable audiobooks, and we have a special offer exclusively for Big Web Show listeners. Audible offers 100,000 books covering virtually every genre. If you want to listen to a book, Audible has it. Listen to audiobooks anytime, anywhere, including iPhones, iPads, computers, Kindles, and so on. And here's the best part. Audible is offering Big Web Show listeners a free audiobook along with a 30-day trial. Go to audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow to take advantage of this special offer. By doing so, you not only get the chance to check out a great service, you support our show as well. And books that you might enjoy are Outliers, The Story of Success by Malcolm Gladwell, Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, David and Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell, Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. I didn't realize he'd written so many books. Oh, and my guest today, Dan Brown, interestingly enough, you seem to have written a pot-boiling bestseller called Inferno. Is that you?
No. Sure.
That might be the other Dan Brown. There is another Dan Brown. Not as interesting from a web design perspective. I prefer your writing, sir. But if you like the pot boilers, if you like the excitement of a page turning frenzy, then the other Dan Brown, his novel Inferno, might be just what you're looking for, I was going to say, but this is Audible. And every word comes alive on Audible, so there you go. So, once again, to wrap that up, get your free audiobook and kick off your free trial at audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. The Big Web Show is also sponsored by Littlecast. Littlecast is a service that lets you sell videos to Facebook fans. Immediately increase revenue and fan interaction by selling your videos to Facebook fans. It's easy to use. Sign up and start selling videos in minutes. And it's completely free. Signing up for Littlecast is free. Littlecast simply takes a portion of sales you make, so there's no risk. For more information, go to littlecast.com/web. And that, my friends, is how we do that. And now we're back with Dan Brown of H-Shapes. How big is your studio now?
We have 12 full-time employees. At our peak, we were 15, and I think we're going to get back up to that. If not this year, then early next year.
Did you downsize, or did people naturally move on and you decided?
We've actually had a solid team for several years. And so I think a number of them sort of got to a good point where they thought they wanted to try something new. So.
Okay. I see that you have National Geographic, who are headquartered in D.C., in the D.C. area.
Yeah, they're a former client. We're not active with them anymore.
They're a great client.
Yeah.
You've had Sprint, FDIC, Marriott. Marriott, wow.
Marriott is also headquartered in the D.C. area.
And would I use a Marriott website when I stay at Marriott? Am I looking at some of your work?
The work that we have been doing for them has not yet launched.
Okay. Very interesting. eBay?
We taught some workshops for them a couple years ago.
Discovery Channel?
Also based in the D.C. area. It was actually Discovery Education. We did some concepting work for them.
D.C. is great. What you say you and your wife moved there in the late
97.
I lived there for a while as well. I lived there for 6 years and I loved it. What brought you to DC?
There were a variety of mostly family related reasons. My wife Sarah is from the DC area originally. I am from the New York City area originally. We both felt that as a young couple just starting out, DC was probably going to have a less steep learning curve. So,
are you in DC proper or in the suburbs?
I live just outside in one of the Maryland suburbs.
Silver Spring.
Bethesda.
Bethesda. Bethesda's nice.
I love it. As a former New Yorker, or expat New Yorker, maybe I should say, it's urban enough for me so that I don't feel like I'm raising my kids in the suburbs.
But good food and shopping.
Yeah, we've got lots of restaurants, lots of smart people.
Close to the zoo.
We are frequent visitors to the National Zoo. Yes.
Very nice. Very nice. You created an interactive guide to the Constitution for the Heritage Foundation?
Yes. Yeah. This was one of our first opportunities to do a responsive site or app. We don't get into political work. Actually, Nathan and I specifically try and avoid anything political, or we've done very little government work as well. And we've been fortunate that we have such a nice chunk of commercial work that we don't have to go there very often. The Heritage Foundation, whether or not you agree with their politics, gave us a long leash, and they actually run projects really well. And so they gave us a lot of opportunity to experiment not only with responsive, which was sort of just emerging at the time, but also designing a website that looked and felt more like an app. And so it really gave us an opportunity to test out some of the new design concepts we were seeing a few years ago.
It's great that, you know, at heart, all this stuff is HTML.
Yes.
It's just content. And yet it looks like it looks not unlike the kinds of things we were designing in the mid 90s, not on the web so much because we couldn't, but
right.
You know,
CD-ROM type things.
CD-ROM. Yeah. Yeah. This has a really a good, not an overwrought baloney CD-ROM, but like a really great one. Right. Feeling to it. And yet I know that it's just well marked up, well structured content, and CSS and a little JavaScript.
Yep, that's what we were going for.
That makes me happy. That is great. Who's responsible at your studio for visual design?
So we have a visual design team. We have two visual designers on staff. We contract out a little bit more visual design. We have a visual design director role currently vacant. We're looking to fill that role. And Nathan and I, because our background is more information architecture, interaction design. Curtis is my partner.
Right.
Because that's more of our role. That's kind of where the company mostly grew. And we're really looking to try and create a better balance between those two disciplines.
It's always hard. You get famous for one thing and then you want to say, well, we're so good at so many things. But I've got to say, I really admire when you're great at UX, when you're known for UX, you tend to attract a following of UX people. For you to be able to be really great at UX and have clients understand why that's important, have clients, high caliber clients, be attracted to you and say, we want to work with you guys. We understand that figuring out our content and structuring it in a way that people can come get it and enjoy it, and we can build a community, that's really important. Because a lot of times, you know, sometimes clients don't major in clientology.
No.
Nobody teaches you how to be a client, and they could go, something's pretty, or it won, you know, it could win an award at an advertising, in an advertising show, and people would think, well, it must be really great because, you know, it won a communication arts award, it won a one show award, and maybe on some level it is great, but it maybe isn't great as the kind of experience they need. It's remarkable and admirable that your clients understand what you do and come to you for it. And do you think all the traveling and speaking helps with that?
That's a good question. You know, I really curtailed my speaking. 2009 was kind of the last year I did a lot of stuff on the road. Nathan too did a lot. I think it was that year. And we both decided, I mean, to be honest, it's a time and materials business that we're in, and we could earn more money. Yes, being in the office, but also I think both had a vision for what we understood our design team needed to become. And that was not going to happen with us on the road. And so we, both of us really stopped. I think I only went to the IA summit each year. And I skipped 2011. That was the first year I skipped the IA Summit.
Did that hurt?
No, my second child was being born at the time. Okay. So I was pretty good.
You were fine.
Yeah, I thought my priorities were really well aligned with that. So
I remember my daughter was born, and I missed South by Southwest for the first time in 2004. And I was like, you know, and I felt, you know, I was like, I'm strangely okay with this. And, yes. And I loved South by Southwest, but I was like, yeah, yeah. You have two boys, right?
Two boys, yes.
4 and 8?
Close. 2.5 and 7.
Big. That's a nice spread.
Yeah, it worked out well for us.
And they get along. The 2.5-year-old must idolize the 7-year-old.
I don't know. I mean, they're not competitive, but it's interesting to watch this relationship kind of. I think they clearly acknowledge that they each have a role in this relationship. And yeah, the little one tries to do whatever the big one does, but he also understands that he's his own man. So
that's cool. Did you want boys?
We thought we were going to have a girl with the first one. And so when we found out it was a boy, it was quite a bit of a shock. Then he came out and he started growing up and he became a huge geek. And we were like, oh, yeah, we could do this. We can make this work.
Well, were you afraid he was going to be like a jock? Like you were somehow going to produce a kid you couldn't completely relate to?
Which isn't happens. That every parent's fear?
I was afraid if I had a boy that I would be a total failure. Yeah.
Yes.
That
yes.
He'd go like, all right, Dad, let's go skiing. And I'd be like,
kind of. People get hurt doing that.
Yeah. There's hot chocolate in the lodge.
Yeah. Know,
yeah.
Yeah. No, I was, my older son and I get along really well because he's sort of, intensely into science. He and my wife have lots of conversations because her general knowledge is far better than mine ever will be. But he also likes playing board games. So we get along really, really well.
Has he played the card game that you designed yet?
He was my first play tester. It was good. I think he was about 5 at the time. And he said the funniest thing to me. He said, Daddy, when I play your card game, it makes me feel relaxed. And I thought, well, that's kind of what I'm going for. So that's what a great testimonial.
To remind listeners, this is a game of like what to do when you're in trouble in a design process. What to do when you know, when the project manager on your team decides to edit the HTML, trying to be helpful.
Yes. Right?
This was a scenario that we developed in our group when we were playing the game at your workshop in Philadelphia the other day. It was like, okay, so what do you do? And I think that the most compassionate answer, the answer that I ended up loving, was ask the person to tell you a story. Like, what were they, you know? It's other people were like, well, yeah, we need to remind them that these roles, you know, thank them for being above and beyond, but remind them roles and responsibilities exist for a reason. There were lots of those kinds of answers, which right. that might be what I would do. It was fascinating to hear someone pull this card and then really live this card and say, get them to tell me a story. What were they trying to achieve? Because maybe there's something there. Maybe there's, you know, maybe we could learn something.
Yeah. The purpose of the game is to, as you say, to kind of help design teams confront situations that they might normally face on a project, but outside the context of a project, such that they are in a safe place, abstracted from, you know, maybe actual interpersonal interactions. The purpose of the game is to get people to, in a sense, tell stories about difficult situations they faced, and then challenge them by getting them to use techniques that they may not normally use. And so I call those techniques patterns. And these are sort of very simple, one phrase summaries of something you can do, like tell a story, you know, play a bad cop, or assert your process, right? These are little things that just might trigger a new way of thinking about dealing with the situation.
Does it worry you at all that you're constantly giving away trade secrets, knowledge? So, for example, not only this product, but you have H-shaped blocks, which you give away, H-shapes unify, which you give away. These are gamified ways of solving problems that you've obviously, you know, that you've struggled in your own careers to discover, and now you're giving them to your competitors. Does that bother you?
No. I mean, I think if it bothered us, we wouldn't do it. But Nathan and I, again, we're sort of very aligned on principles. And even though we come at design from different angles, we have a very firm belief in connecting with and giving back to the community. And as I've gotten older and more experienced, that takes different shapes, right? That's different things. You know, in 2009, that was me doing a conference every month. And then burning out and getting angry at myself and realizing I've got other ways I can give back. Nathan is also really interested in team dynamics, but I think from the angle of how do we create actual tools that they can use on the screen to make their jobs, if not specifically geared toward making them easier, making them more effective designers. And that's why he creates these tools like Unify and Blocks and posts them.
How do you train the people who work with you and work for you and clients? How do you train them in the way that you want to approach something?
That's a great question. We acknowledge that acclimating to any new culture is hard, right? You get a new employee at Happy Cog, they've maybe been with, I don't know, Razorfish or Deloitte or somewhere else for a long time. And they have a way of thinking about the problem, and you need to help acclimate them to the way your shop likes to think about the problem. For us, we've really invested a lot of time in creating an onboarding process that helps them understand the things they should be worried about, the things they should be paying attention to.
Is it all documentation? Is it experiences? Like, we give them three breakfasts and a tour. I mean, are there activities that you go through? Like, we take them to this museum and say, see this? This is what we do. Or look at this dinosaur. That's what we, I don't know.
That's interesting. I might add that to the mix once the museums open back up. But we have a welcome package, right, that sort of tries to boil down and summarize everything, yes, you need to know as an employee, like your benefits, but also all of the the essential things that makes H-Shapes. The way we track our time, the way we think about projects, the way we think about people being assigned to projects, things like that. Things that, in essence, form the soul of H-Shapes. But we have other mechanisms, too. So our onboarding includes a series of meetings, like a 15-day, a 30-day check-in, three-month check-in, which is either a Skype call or a coffee with your manager to kind of just check in and see where you're going.
So you have some remote workers.
We are exclusively distributed. So
interesting.
The vast majority of our employees are here in the DC area. So we will get together. We get together as project teams in shared workspaces, but we also
in Fairfax. Or is that more of a mailing address?
Some people are in Fairfax. Some people are on that side of the river. Some people are on the other side of the river. We tend to get together in downtown DC because that ends up being the most central location.
And fun.
It can be. Can be. If you're younger, I guess.
What? I'm younger?
I said if one is younger,
got it.
You might like schlepping into downtown DC.
Okay.
Yeah.
I used to live there, so I did like it. But the museums are closed. It's horrible. I mean, it's horrible.
It is horrible. My older son was so incensed that the zoo was closed and the museums were closed that he said we had to make a trip up to the Baltimore Aquarium because that was not closed. So that was going to be his form of protest, was going to the Baltimore Aquarium.
I like that kid.
Yeah, he's interesting boy. Yes,
he didn't just express rage and, you know, frustration. He had a plan.
Yeah. He didn't stand forlornly at the gates of the National Zoo. So
yeah, he lit a candle.
Yes, exactly.
That's really cool. I could do this all day, and I'm really enjoying this, but. But we are running short on time, so I want to thank you for all the time you've given us today. The book is Designing Together, the Collaborative and Conflict Management Handbook for Creative Professionals. You are Dan Brown. You are on Twitter. You are Brownorama.
Correct.
I guess that on Facebook, you're Dan Brown.
Yeah, not much.
Yeah. Well, you got to be on there.
I'm on there just so I can see pictures of my nephew, but that's pretty much it.
Okay. So Twitter is the way to go. Brownorama on Twitter, hshapes.com, and what personal site?
I blog at greenonions.com.
Like the song.
Yes. It was named for the song. Thank you.
Yeah. Cool.
I haven't updated that in a while. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I can tell this has been around for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been focused on other things. I've got a new side project going with Samantha Soma. We are actually ramping up a podcast on collaboration and conflict topics. So we are a little ways away from launching, but we've got that in the works.
That's fantastic. Are you going to self-host that, or are you going to be on a network?
We are taking it slow.
Okay. We've just started calling this internet radio again instead of podcast.
I love it.
What do you think?
We're starting
about
an internet radio show, is what I meant to say.
Isn't that it's better, right?
Yeah, I like it.
Mike Montero convinced me of that, and I think
I
think that's One day we won't even have to say internet radio. We'll just say it's a radio show or an audio show.
Just like we don't have to say internet TV
anymore. Yeah.
I guess we call it Hulu now. So.
Or Netflix, or we say I saw House of Cards, not I saw the video podcast House of Cards, or the downloadable Kevin Spacey starring House of Cards internet thing.
It was streaming.
It was streaming.
Yeah.
But you know what? So is my cable.
Yeah.
It's all streaming. It's all streaming. It's just a different way of paying, and it comes from a different box, and that'll all change soon.
And the kids don't care these days.
The kids don't care, but they don't watch TV. They say they don't own a TV, and then they watch tons of TV on their device. So come on, you're watching TV. Well, listen, this has been great. I really want to thank you. Dan Brown is the guy. This was episode 100. Thank you for being part of the history making 100th episode. And
Jeffrey, it was my honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. We'll talk again soon. And
this is my dad, everyone.
And there you go. Bye-bye now.